You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Happy Saturday, everybody. Welcome back to Locked On Rockets, the only daily podcast covering the NBA's winningest team. I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official flagship. We don't always have podcasts on Saturday, but this is an exception for a pretty clear reason. That's because the Rockets, they're hard at work today because they finally know their round two opponent, and it's coming very, very quickly. The opponent, of course, the Utah Jazz. Series starts 2:30 Sunday afternoon Houston time at Toyota Center. That's because the Jazz took care of business in Game 6 against the Thunder late Friday night. Incredibly fast turnaround. They finished the game after midnight Houston time. They're hopping on a flight this afternoon. And then early Sunday afternoon, 1:30, according to their body time back in Utah, they have to get ready for Game 1 of the next series. So the Rockets, at least in Game 1, should certainly have a physical advantage, having a few days off, to the Jazz, who are just in a whirlwind of activity. They're also likely to be without Ricky Rubio, strained hamstring. He had to leave Game 6 early, a game which the Jazz almost had to win. I don't give them much chance at all in winning a Game 7 at Oklahoma City if they had lost Game 6 and blown a 25-point lead in Game 5. So for Rubio to be ruled out in that game, that tells you that it's not just a run-of-the-mill strain. There's something there. He's been battling it for a month or so. And I think to get that healed up, you're looking at least probably a week off, in my opinion, not just Game 1, but Game 2 as well. I think the earliest you see Ricky Rubio would be Game 3 in Salt Lake City. I could be wrong. That's just my read on it thus far. Even so, though, the Jazz, a very tough opponent. Over the final 3 months of the year, they were the highest-rated team in the NBA. Now, I think offensively, there are some clear deficiencies, but overall, they're a fantastic defensive team, first or second in the league by nearly every metric, anchored by Rudy Gobert, tremendous coach in Quinn Snyder, and offensively, Donovan Mitchell. I like the comparison I saw from some folks on Twitter this morning of a young Dwayne Wade, but with a better jumper. He is simply incredible. Actually, in a Game 6, a do-or-die against Russell Westbrook, in my opinion, he outplayed Russell Westbrook. Mitchell had 38 points, including, I believe, 20 or more in the third quarter on just 26 shots. I say just 26 shots because Westbrook had, I believe, 45, but he did it on 43 shots. So Mitchell actually went mano on mano with one of the NBA's lead guards in Russell Westbrook and held his own, and his team got the win, even with Ricky Rubio not playing. That's how good the Jazz are defensively. And offensively, while I would say they're limited, there's enough there with Donovan Mitchell to where you could argue that they're ahead of where they were a year ago, even when they had Gordon Hayward. So the Jazz, it's a phenomenal story. And so to discuss them a little more, I'm going to be joined momentarily by David Locke. He is at Locked On Sports on Twitter. He's a good Utah follow throughout the series for those of us in Houston. That's because he's the radio play-by-play voice of the Jazz. So he'll have the calls across the Jazz radio network. And he's also the host of the Locked On Jazz podcast and the Locked On NBA podcast. So he's a great voice, not just on Utah commentary, but the league as a whole. So to talk about the Jazz, the challenges they pose defensively and really up and down the roster, and also the four prior matchups, you've already made a case for the Rockets beyond the fact that they won 65 games, a heck of a lot more than the Jazz, who I believe finished in the upper 40s, then the case for the Rockets would be they beat the Jazz all four times this season, including the finale in Utah, even with the Rockets on night two of a road back-to-back. And in my opinion, it's because the Jazz, they're a great defensive team. The Rockets, they're a great offensive team. The difference is that the other side of the ball, the Rockets' defense is better than the Jazz offense. The Rockets' defense this year ranks sixth in the NBA, and when they're fully healthy, we've seen them be legitimately top five. And the good news on Saturday, the breaking news from the Houston side of the fence, it's that they are closer to being healthy than they have been in some time. That's because Luke Bamute, he was a full participant in practice today, and if all goes well, if his body responds the way they hope it will, then he could easily play in Game 1 tomorrow. If not Game 1, I would think definitely by Wednesday's Game 2. So Luke Bamute, he's a big deal because he's certainly Houston's, I would say, most flexible and versatile defender. We saw his absence a lot in the Minnesota series because while Trevor Ariza and PJ Tucker are certainly very good defenders in their own right, they're not necessarily as quick or as long. And so dribble penetration with the likes of Jeff Teague and Derrick Rose was a problem. Certainly Donovan Mitchell can do that, and Ricky Rubio, if he's able to come back, the Jazz can pose some problems. Even Alec Burks, guys like that off the bench, there's some athleticism. Dante Exum, there's some playmaking potential, and so Luke gives you more versatility, more quickness, more length on the perimeter, so he'll help you individually. But where he really helps you is in playing small ball lineups to potentially take that Jazz defense out of sorts, because that final Rockets-Jazz matchup that I mentioned, the Rockets won it because in the fourth quarter, Luke had 15 points. He made his threes. He attacked Rudy Gobert off the dribble and even had a couple of dunks in there. But what was most noteworthy about it was in how the Rockets essentially abandoned their bigger lineups altogether. The first round, now Clint Capella did play well, extremely well against Karl Anthony Towns. Nene was better than expected, but to some degree, the Rockets had to play big. They couldn't really play small with these Ryan Anderson at the five or these tuck wagon lineups with PJ Tucker in there, because if you bump those guys to the five, then who's going to fill the minutes at the forward spots? Because for various reasons, Gerald Green's defense with Joe Johnson and his shooting slash age slash athleticism, I don't know that Mike D'Antoni truly trusted those guys to play 25 plus minutes on a regular basis, given some of those deficiencies. He does trust Luke Bamute, and so because of that, there's a trickle down effect to where then you're more free to play smaller lineups with guys like PJ Tucker, Ryan Anderson at the five, and perhaps that's how you take the Jazz out of sorts. That's what they did the last time these two teams played. That doesn't mean Clint Capella has no role. He's certainly going to play at a minimum, I'd say 25 minutes every game. But Rudy Gobert, he's a unique challenge. He is a bear inside, just an incredible presence. And so sometimes you may not be able to beat them just one-on-one, Capella against Gobert. You may need to kind of scheme them out of it. And that's where Luke Bamute, beyond just what he gives you himself, comes into play. I think the Rockets with Luke, it's always been a matter of getting him as much rest as you can. I think now that the shoulder's been dislocated twice, there's certainly a chance it could happen again. As much time as they could buy him, that's great because it gives the shoulder more time to heal up. But realistically, it's an issue of pain tolerance. And for the Rockets, it's a matter of how much time can they buy without him. They got through the first round, 1 in 5 games, before his presence becomes absolutely necessary. Even Friday, when they didn't know the opponent, they listed him as doubtful. I think maybe that's because the possibility of not even starting the series until Tuesday night if it was Oklahoma City. And maybe you don't need him as much against Oklahoma City. You could make that case. But against Utah, especially with the challenge of Gobert defensively, the ability to play small, that extra flexibility and what it means up and down the roster, I think that's where Luke is especially important. He was a full participant in practice today, and if all goes well, they'll see how he responds immediately after practice. They'll see how he wakes up in the morning, and they'll make a final decision when they get to Toyota Center around lunchtime tomorrow. But if it's not game one, barring any sort of unforeseen setback, I do think it will be game two, and that ultimately that's a very big deal for the Rockets, because Luke, James Harden said it at practice today, they were lucky to get through the first round without him, but big picture, Luke is a big part of where they want to go. To actually beat the Warriors 4 times out of 7, you need that level of defense. And so for the Rockets against this series with the Jazz, one of the best defensive teams in the NBA, and then to get ready for what we all assume is the Warriors on the horizon right after that, then it's a very welcome sign to see Luke back as a full participant at practice. And him being there is a big part of the Rockets' upside, not just this series, but beyond. As far as this series, the Rockets enter certainly game one would appear to be in their favor at home. The Jazz on a very quick turnaround. Rockets not having played since Wednesday, so they're the rested team. They're at home. You have to think they have an advantage in game one. And then from there, the Jazz, I know what the data shows you, being arguably the NBA's best team in the final two and a half months of the year. They even beat the Warriors 3 times in there, all by 19 or more points, 2 of them by 30+. So the Jazz can be very good. But offensively, the downside to the Jazz, their offense, it's more of a deficiency than the downside to the Rockets, which is Houston's defense, which, as we've said, is 6th of the NBA, and even better than that when they have their full complement of players, which it appears they're pretty poised to do almost imminently with the return of Luke Bamute. So that ultimately, that's why I think the Rockets have the upper hand in this series. The Jazz just a little bit undermanned offensively, especially if Ricky Rubio is not able to go. And for the Rockets, I think they're actually comfortable playing at the pace the Jazz want to play at. One thing the Jazz do so good, and part of the reason why I think that teams hate playing them, is because they're so unique, they slow that pace to a crawl, and for a lot of teams, especially younger athletic teams, it can take them out of their element. The Rockets this year, they've been one of the slowest paced teams in the league since the start of February. This is not a quintessential Mike D'Antoni team. led by Chris Paul and James Harden, the Rockets have shown an ability this year to play in the half court, to make winning plays one-on-one late, even in a pace that is at a crawl. And so ultimately that gives them a dimension that I don't think even last year in the second round against San Antonio that they had. And so I think that versatility is especially important to them, not just in terms of individual matchups, but the team collectively in terms of the style that it's comfortable playing at in this series. And so I think it's why the Rockets enter as favorites, and especially if you consider the injuries to Utah, you might could even argue that the Jazz are an easier matchup for them than the Timberwolves were. Keep in mind, the Timberwolves would have been a 51 plus win team. That's the pace they were on, if not for Jimmy Butler tearing his meniscus and them going on a slide in the final couple of months of the year. That's just my early read on the situation, though. I do want to get perspective from the other side, so I'm going to be joined in just a couple of moments by David Locke. Again, he's the radio voice of the Utah Jazz, calls all of their games play-by-play on the Jazz Radio Network, and of course, he's also the godfather of us here at the Lockdown Podcast Network. He hosts the Lockdown Jazz Show, the Lockdown NBA Show, just a great resource for information across the association. It's a very busy day for David because they wrapped up very late last night. Now they're hopping on a plane this afternoon to get to Houston. But I was lucky enough to get him for a few moments heading to the airport, and here's a playback of that conversation and our initial thoughts on this round two series between the Jazz and the Rockets. Ben Dubose here of Locked On Rockets, joined by David Locke, host of Locked On Jazz, Locked On NBA, and probably most importantly, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, previewing this second round series between the Rockets and the Jazz. David, we'll get to the Rockets in a few minutes, but I want to start by what's been, I'm sure, a crazy 12 hours for you. You're on your way to the airport as I'm recording this. Talk about what that game last night was like, what it meant for the franchise, and just how crazy the travel schedule is as you somehow turn around in about 36 hours to go from what felt like a heavyweight fight to now getting ready for a brand new series starting Sunday afternoon at Toyota Center in Houston.
Yeah, I don't think it felt like a heavyweight fight. I think it was, and I think Oklahoma City was physically probably dominant at most positions. Maybe not Derek Favors, Carmelo Anthony, and maybe not, if, you know, depends if you, Corey Brewer, Joe Ingles, but even if Paul George probably physically dominates Donovan Mitchell. So it's a tired bunch that's jumping on an airplane. But last night they might have been able to fly themselves there. That was quite a win. Rubio goes out 7 minutes in with a hamstring injury. It really flustered them for a while, and then they somehow, Joe Ingles had two big threes late, they somehow ended up at 41 all at halftime, which is what is tricky about the Jazz, is that they can be just playing the worst offense, which they were in the first half last night, and then hit a few shots, and because the defense is so dominant, you're all of a sudden back in the game. The defensive rating or offensive rating for both teams was 86 at halftime last night. And then the Jazz hit them early in the third. Russell decided that he wanted to see if he could will it back by himself. He scored every point for 12 minutes for the Thunder. And then the Jazz, you know, clung to the end, including a minute-long possession by the Thunder where they missed five shots, and then finally having Paul George really bail. I think he might have been fouled, but more importantly to me, Paul George bailing out on what would have been a good look. And when you think about the fact that he's one of 26 in his career in the final 24 seconds of a close game from three, I think he knew that. Remember, the whole C.J. Miles thing happens last year. It's all over SportsCenter. They tear up a late from three, and he hits one this year, and it was his first one ever. I think he, you know, he may have been fouled. That's a legitimate question. But more to me is he bailed out on wanting to get a good look. He's looking for his excuse rather than his make. And it turned out to win the series for the Jazz. Incredible series for Utah. And I think from a big picture standpoint, if Utah can beat Oklahoma City, so if Utah without their best player who misses 35 games of the season and has the same record as Oklahoma City at the end of the year and then beats them in a playoff series, why does every single basketball pundit in the world believe that an Oklahoma City team is better than a Utah team? We should probably start recalibrating what we think about some things in the game.
Yeah, and by the way, I completely agree with you on the Paul George moment at the end of the game. Look for the shot. He jumps sideways into Gobert. Maybe it's a foul, maybe it's not, but we've seen throughout NBA history there's a reluctance to give that whistle there. Bottom line is he had Gobert in the air. All he had to do was take a step to the side, and he's going to have a wide open look from three to tie the game. And instead, he tried to draw the foul. It was a cheap attempt. Maybe there was contact, but ultimately, I have no problem with the Jazz getting the benefit of the doubt on that. I want to ask you before we go any deeper about Ricky Rubio, because last night, to me, it felt like a game the Jazz had to have. I don't think there was much confidence if it goes to Game 7 in Oklahoma City after blowing the 25-point lead in Game 5, and if you had also lost a Game 6 at home. So to see the Jazz rule out Rubio so quickly, and he has had ongoing issues with a hamstring for a month, to me, that was a signal that it must be a decent strain, which I know they have all the technology in the world. We'll see what happens. But my guess, after seeing it live, I'd be surprised if he played Game 1 or 2 in Houston. Just curious what you're seeing on the ground and what you saw after the game with how Rubio's walking and the level of concern about that.
I didn't get to see any of our players after the game. I spent some time with our coaches, but I didn't see. I would be surprised. I really try to stay away from the injury thing just because you don't really know. Mm-hmm. And then they don't really tell us. But I think everything you said is reasonable. The Jazz are rooting for the Bucks to beat the Celtics. That pushes Game 3 to Saturday and then Monday. So it would give Ricky another day. But I don't know if maybe that's even too optimistic. Ricky's been really good. He's great at picking apart defenses. On the other end, the Rockets switch, the highest percentage, about 59% of all think picks the Rockets switch, which is the highest percentage in the league, I believe.
Yep.
That's not when Ricky's very good, because he's not a one-on-one player and he's not a contested shooter. What Ricky's very good at is if you're playing a structural defense that the Jazz kind of, what they call get the blender going, where they penetrate into the paint and then start kicking it around, Ricky can often make the first pass to start the blender. In other words, he reads where the defense is compromised, hits the right guy either for a right away open look or the blender starts. That's why his assist numbers were down this year, but he was probably just as valuable as he's making the first pass that gets it started. And then if it comes back to him, for all the criticism of his shooting, he's a 38% open three-point shooter. But he's a 24% guarded three-point shooter, and he's not a particularly good finisher at the rim. So if everyone's switching everything, he's not one who's going to go beat you off the dribble. And so maybe this isn't just naturally actually isn't even a great series for him with the way the Rockets play.
Good point. I hadn't really thought of that. Before we go too much into the matchups, I want to give you a chance to take your victory lap. Because I remember last summer, we did a show for Lockdown NBA in the middle of all the Carmelo rumors, and you threw a lot of cold water on the idea that even relative to just Ryan Anderson, because of all the offseason rumors linking Carmelo to the Rockets, of course, you were a big proponent that even relative to just a one-for-one swap with Ryan Anderson, you weren't convinced that that would make the Rockets much better, if any. So now that a season is done, I think it's pretty clear that Carmelo in that Oklahoma City-Utah series was by far the biggest weakness for the Thunder. Why did you see this coming and basically take your victory lap if you want?
Well, if Daryl Morey would like to go to lunch this week, I would like to go to lunch with him. And I'd like him to be honest. I'm guessing he never wanted Carmelo.
Mm.
I'm guessing he placated Chris Paul,
okay,
who was new to the team. And knowing Daryl, the mad scientist, maybe he was even trying to create a market for a guy that he knew had no value.
Mm.
There was nothing that ever made sense to me about the Rockets signing Carmelo. He's an inefficient, high-volume, isolation, mid-range player. Now, Chris Paul could be some of that, but Chris Paul's always been efficient. So I just never made sense to me, and I think the biggest, maybe biggest is too strong a word, a tremendously detrimental piece to a puzzle is a inefficient, high-usage player on a team that already has high-usage player or players. Let me say that again. I talked about this with Kevin Pelton on the Thursday edition of Lockdown NBA this week. So I really fundamentally, one of my biggest beliefs, I have two kind of, if I was a general manager building a team. One is, I want every player above average. I don't actually need them all to be great. I just need them above average. That way, when the ball swings, if you force it out of James Harden or Chris Paul's hands, if everybody's above average, then I'm still getting a decent possession, and then the possessions where I do get it from my stars, then I'm unstoppable. It's really where the Rockets are right now. It's very similar to where Miami was with LeBron, Bosch, and Wade. But the worst thing that you can have is high-usage players who are efficient and then add a high-usage inefficient player. They have no value. In fact, they have huge detrimental value. You're far better off dispersing those 15, 20 possessions amongst your average players, one or two apiece. It won't push them. It will push them too much if you don't have another high-usage player. But Andrew Wiggins in Minnesota is incredibly detrimental to who they are, even though they're still one of the best offensive teams. But if they took those possessions and moved them just naturally around average players, they'd be tremendous amount better than they are right now.
Yeah, and I think that's a good parallel for what's going on with Oklahoma City. I think you could certainly see it throughout round one in that OKC Utah six gamer, to the point where I think by game six, it was just basically a political decision for Billy Donovan, how much he had to do for the better of the team versus the blowback from not playing Carmelo Anthony in an elimination game. David, I want to
say, knowing you have him on the roster next year for $23 million, and that he's close with Paul George. Like Billy, I thought Billy dealt with it really well. I thought he was pretty creative. You played him at center last night for a while. I thought Billy Donovan was really, really creative, and he'll get a lot of flack for that series. I don't think he deserves it. I thought he, being embedded in that series, I thought Billy Donovan did a lot of good things.
Yeah, I thought especially the second half of Game 5 when they started switching on everything, it was a good adjustment. It gave the Jazz some problems. And that's what I want to transition to talking about the Jazz and the Rockets. I know you haven't gotten a chance to do too much scouting at this point, but it's well documented that what changed in Game 5 when the Thunder outscored you guys by 33 over the final 20-plus minutes of the game was the switching philosophy. You mentioned earlier that Houston does it as much as any team in the NBA. So at face value, it's a bad matchup. The Rockets did win all four in the regular season, although none of them came in March or April, so it has been a while since the Rockets have seen the Jazz. What do you take out of those first four games? What are your initial thoughts, not having really dived into the data? And how do the Jazz adjust? What's the counter to what Houston does, switching defensively and the various looks that they throw at you?
Let me start with the four games. Matt Bullard and I had a unique lunch in Salt Lake City. I'm not sure it was a good lunch. We went to a weird place. I don't know if he thought it was any good or not. We'll have to find out from Paul whether he thought it was any good. And we talked about this. The sign to me this year that the Rockets were legitimate were how much trouble they gave us. If you go back over the past 2 years, I thought the Jazz covered the Rockets better than anyone else could bear. And the ball wouldn't get out to your three-point shooters. You guys would almost get antsy because you weren't getting enough threes. Guys were taking contested, uncomfortable looks because they had to have threes. And the Jazz, I thought, gave the Rockets a lot of trouble. I think Harden had a mammoth game and beat them 2 years ago, and the Jazz won one or two. But it was a matchup you could feel the Rockets weren't comfortable. This year felt the exact opposite. This year the Rockets just seemed like they were so much better than they were a year ago, and they seemed totally comfortable. Now, I would like to go back, and I'll do the analysis to look at how many minutes Rodney Hood and Joe Johnson were on the floor for the Jazz, because they both were really terrible defensively. And so what impact that has, Jay Crowder played the last game against the Rockets, and that game, I think the Rockets didn't have Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson, but the Jazz defense really worked in that game, but the Jazz couldn't score either. So that gets to part two of what you're saying, is in the last time these two teams played, the Jazz could not score. And I think the Jazz for series will help them a bit in the sense that they had switching and they had to deal with it. They got better and better. And frankly, Donovan Mitchell's unbelievable. And, you know, I mean, I think we've got to start putting him up really high on the list of offensive players in the league. And he's one of the best isolation offensive players. Quinn Snyder, in the coach's show, Game 6, literally just said, you know what, they're going to switch everything. Donovan just might be good enough if we give him the ball. That's a pretty incredible comment from a head coach. And so it might be a little simple. It might get to be, you know what, you're switching, and we're going to go get Harden, and we're going to make him guard Donovan, and Donovan's going to go to work, and hopefully Donovan, who is not a natural point guard at all and does not do a great job on reads, starts to make some good reads. But they're going to go hard down.
David, I want to ask you about the matchup in the middle. Which concerns you more, the Rockets' ability to go small or what Clint Capella showed you in round one? Because Capella against Minnesota, Carl Anthony Towns in particular, now Towns a good player, but very different skill set than Rudy Gobert. But Capella, in terms of the degree to which he succeeded in that series, was stunning to me. Capella was incredible. And yet, when you look at the Rockets versus the Jazz specifically during the year, it was actually when they went small that seemed to pose the biggest problems. The big news out of the Rockets practice earlier this morning, David, was that Luke Bamute is suddenly questionable. Yesterday, he was doubtful. It didn't look like that he was going to play. They say to get reevaluated in the middle of next week, and we'll see maybe later in the second round. Well, all of a sudden, 24 hours later, he's reportedly made, according to D'Antoni, good progress, and they're putting him through a full participation today, and if all goes well, he'll play tomorrow. And I think, of course, Luke's a very good defensive player, but the other reason they do that is that if you play small, and it's something the Rockets did a lot this year to kind of space out Gobert, either with Ryan Anderson shooting, maybe those tuck wagon lineups with P.J. Tucker in the middle, either way, if you do that, you've got a lot of minutes at the forward spots that you need someone to fill. I don't think D'Antoni fully trusts Gerald Green or Joe Johnson, so that's where having Luke Bamute back, it's not just what he does himself, and he did have a big role. I think he had 15 points in the fourth quarter the last time the Rockets and the Jazz played. That was the one in Salt Lake City. But in general, he gives you more flexibility to go small. So your thoughts, obviously Rudy Gobert is the difference maker for the Jazz defensively, the best or second best team in the league, all that sorts of things. Are you more concerned about Capella one-on-one, or are you concerned about the Rockets going small and what that does with the trickle-down effects up and down the roster?
So, you're absolutely right, and you just, you know, I have very poor game recall, so you reminded me of something. The fourth matchup, the Jazz, I think, are going to look like they're going to win that game, or at least they're playing pretty close, and then Luke Bamute plays center and scores a ton in that fourth quarter. And Gobert really struggles with it because he's out on the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Gobert's actually pretty good on the perimeter because he's so big, but it pulls him out, right? So that's the problem is that then you swing it, and Rudy's going to come back down, and then Bamute's open for three. You know, on the other end, if the Jazz lose this series because Luke Bamute makes a bunch of shots, like, I'm okay with that. Like, to me, that means the Jazz got the Rockets out of what they do. I'd love to get beat this week by P.J. Tucker, Luke Bamute, maybe even Trevor Ariza. I'd rather not get beat by James Harden, Chris Paul, and Eric Gordon. Like, I think Eric Gordon hit a bunch of threes in game one or two against us this year.
Yep.
So I think Luke Bamute coming back is a huge deal. Don't misunderstand me. But if you want to go small and it means that you're shooting threes with Bamute, I got it. Daryl, don't be listening right now and think I don't got the math on it. But it's still better math than we get other places. And it's a little bit to where we started this about my whole thing about I have a rating called PAC, where Bamute is an average to above average offense. Like, he's right on average a year ago, and I'm assuming he's the same this year. If not, maybe a little better. And so that's what makes the Rockets great, is that you get it out of Chris Paul, and you get it out of Eric Gordon, you get it out of James Harden, the guy who's going to shoot still average. But maybe he's not going to be average in the final 5 minutes of a playoff game, or maybe he's not going to be average if the Jazz steal game two on Wednesday and it's close in game three, right? You just, maybe there's some other factor from a Jazz standpoint. You're obviously trying to pull off a mammoth upset. I think it would be, I haven't looked at it, but you know, I think you would go in toward Denver, Seattle as one of the largest win discrepancy upsets ever in the history of the NBA. So, you know, what the Jazz are trying to achieve here is pretty monumental. And to me, game one is pretty well shot already.
Yeah, so essentially if you're the Jazz, you're building for game two on Wednesday. And then I guess hoping you're saying for game three on Saturday, that's if Milwaukee wins, correct?
Right. And I think, you know, here's the question that I still have on the Rockets. I've done very little prep today. But I thought it was interesting how bad the three-point shooting numbers were on a lot of those guys. Like, James and Chris Paul were fine, or relative. But if I saw it right, Eric Gordon, Trevor Ariza, P.J. Tucker, like, they didn't shoot well last series. And take, you know, I got, again, I understand the math, but I regular season three. And I do think if you're tight, that the three is a harder shot to make than the, you know, 3 footer at the rim. So was there anything there, Ben, to those numbers, those brief little things I looked at? It didn't look like overall the numbers were down a little, what, about 2 percentage points? But
yeah.
It looked like some individuals really had a tough series.
Yeah, the good news for the Rockets, the glass half full, is that the second half of Game 4 and all of Game 5, those guys were really good. I think Game 5, Ariza, Tucker, and Gordon were combined 12 of 21 from 3, and those were guys that were well below 30% through the first 3 games. So yeah, it could be. Playoff defenses are tougher. I think Minnesota in particular was a lot more dialed in with Butler than their regular season averages would suggest. The other thing to keep in mind with the Rockets is that they've had such a unique situation with having clinched the 1 seed before March even ended. I think to start that first round series, it had basically been 2 weeks since they'd even played a competitive game to where they treated it with real intensity. So I think part of the problem, the question is how much, part of it was just trying to get guys back into regular rhythms after basically playing 2 weeks of basketball where the primary goal was don't get hurt. So I think you saw that. They did finish that series well, the second half of Game 4 when they went on that crazy run, all of Game 5. But ultimately, you're right. For the series, for the 5 games, they were down a little bit, and it's something to watch. And I guess that leads into my final segment about it.
Well, let me jump in because I've got a question on that.
Sure.
And I'm begging a little bit here. It's worth noting that the Rockets had the best. There's only two teams. The Jazz play. If the Rockets play money ball on offense, the Jazz play money ball on defense. The Jazz are the second best money ball defense in the NBA. And there's only two teams that bend the Jazz defense, and that's Cleveland and Houston. It's because of LeBron and James. So, LeBron and James, not LeBron James. So I'm begging a little bit here. But Minnesota's terrible defensive team. Is there any thought that the Rockets could be off in the sense that they haven't played a good defensive team in a while?
You could see that. I think especially around the rim. I think Minnesota's perimeter defense in round one was a little better than you might think. Now, still not good. Don't get me wrong. They were a little more dialed in. But I do think that Rudy Gobert, after 5 games of Karl Anthony Towns, it's going to be a different challenge. So I think there's something there. Now, the Rockets, down the stretch of the year, they played some pretty good defensive teams. They went through a week in which, you know, they had Portland, they had Oklahoma City when they were playing for a playoff spot. So it's not like they had San Antonio, I believe. I'm forgetting. They played a pretty good slate down the stretch of the season. So it's not like it's been a while, but it has been a while since they've, under high-pressure conditions, played a team that's as good as Utah's going to be. The first words out of James Harden's mouth today when they asked him at practice about, you know, what do you think about the Jazz? Very, very, very good defensive team. So I do think there's something there. The Jazz will definitely be a huge step up over Minnesota. And ultimately, I guess that leads into the final thing I wanted to ask you about, which is for the Jazz to compete in the series, to win at least 2 games, is it a matter of the Jazz doing something right or the Rockets doing something wrong? I'm just curious from your standpoint how much upside the Jazz have, because to me the question is offensively, can the Jazz score enough points? The Rockets, you know what they do offensively, and even if the pace is slow, which is something the Jazz are good at, we've talked about this before this season, David, that's where the Rockets, actually since the start of February, they've been one of the slowest paced teams in the NBA. So the Rockets are more comfortable executing in those half-court settings, and I think the Jazz use that a lot to just kind of throw off the pace, the feel, the rhythm for a lot of teams. So for the Jazz, do you trust that they can step up? I mean, it's Donovan Mitchell to score enough points down the stretch late in games, or is it a matter of the Jazz need something fundamentally to go wrong with the Rockets, essentially to muck it up, and then hope that you make a couple of plays late?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the Jazz will try to win 4 games, not 2.
Okay. well, I'm at 2 or more.
I'm just giving you a hard time. I agree. I think this one's pretty, on paper, I think this one's going to look very one-sided. It might be in reality. The Rockets are great. I think the scenario in which the Jazz can win this series is just using kind of a money ball approach is to increase variance. So if Gobert can eliminate some of the shots in the restricted area by the Rockets and now increase the variance of performance on the three-point shooting, maybe the Rockets have a bad shooting night, or they probably have a great shooting night too, And then the question gets to be whether the Jazz can have, who took, I think, the fifth most amount of threes in the league, nowhere near the 50% that the Rockets did, but can the Jazz have a good three-point shooting night in the midst of that? And so suddenly if you do that for a few possessions, you know, suddenly you have, let's say the Rockets, you know, don't shoot well with a few days off or whatever reason on, you know, they went to the Pink concert Friday night or whatever reason on game one and somehow the Jazz steal it and then the Jazz shoot well in game three, then maybe the variance hits again in game four, you know, I don't know. You're definitely playing it. You're trying to get, you know, the coin to flip seven times on heads and that's unlikely, but I think that's what the Jazz have to do is increase the variance in the sense of getting more threes off offensively and then just eliminating shots at the rim with Gobert, which, you know, I think everyone misses the boat on the Rockets and the Warriors when they talk about all their three-point shooting. A lot of what the key is how good they are at the rim, which then allows for that swing of three-point shooting to always kind of be okay. And if you can eliminate that and force some more shots out, I think that would be it. The question I have for you is, I know there were very few of them this year, but is there any common thread in the losses by the Rockets this year?
We're talking about the regular season as well?
Yeah, just is there, I mean, there's only one postseason loss.
That's
so
true.
Is there any, you know, I'm going to dig into it on the airplane today, but is there suddenly that you didn't get shots in the restricted area, or is it just that threes didn't fall, or, you know, is there any common, maybe it's, you know, is there any common thread in the losses by the Rockets this year?
Yeah, the biggest far and away is that the threes didn't fall. I know that's kind of trite, but it's the truth with this team. They shoot so much that ultimately, if they make them at even a 35% clip, the volume and the math problem, as gets discussed so much with the Rockets-Minnesota series, is so much that most teams can't match them. In terms of X's and O's, the one thing, and it's been less of a problem this year, but what has given them some problems, and it's something the Jazz will try to do, is teams that are able to drop back defensively on the pick and rolls like San Antonio did last year in that series, and also hug the shooters. Now, they've gotten better at it this year because of the addition of Chris Paul. They're more able to take mid-range shots. Also, one thing James Harden, even from year to year, Harden's gotten a lot better at his floater game, the teardrops. You wouldn't necessarily call it a mid-range game, but something that he has to take when the threes aren't there, and he's also not able to get straight to the rim because of the opposing big. That's the one thing I would go back to. Maybe they occasionally have issues with dribble penetration, although I think because there's not a lot of quickness on the perimeter in terms of perimeter defenders, but I think that goes down if Bamute comes back. I would say beyond threes, the biggest thing that gives them problems are teams that hug the shooters and are also capable of sagging back and protecting the rim and basically daring them. Can Chris Paul do it with the mid-range shots? And is James Harden good enough in his in-between game, those teardrops, those floaters? That's what they couldn't do against San Antonio a year ago. And ultimately, my guess is that's what Quinn Snyder's going to make them do in this game. And then, of course, you know, as far as the threes go, you'd rather, as you said earlier, you'd rather guys like Ariza and Tucker shoot as opposed to Harden and Paul. But that goes without saying. In terms of stylistically, I think it's force that in-between game, make them uncomfortable, take away the threes and the layups. Don't let them on the foul line as much as James Harden wants. And if Chris Paul and James Harden can beat you from mid-range and on the floaters, then you just have to live with it because the Rockets have so many options that there's just not a whole lot else that the opponent can do.
Well, guess who the best team in the NBA at forcing teams to do that is?
The one with Rudy Gobert?
Yep. So that's the scenario right there. I don't think it's likely, but the Jazz are the best team in the NBA at doing that.
Yep, I would buy that looking at the defensive numbers. Anyway, folks, thanks as always to everyone for tuning in. I'm Ben Dubose with Locked In Rockets. If you're a Jazz fan listening and want more insight from the Rockets side of the fence, I can be followed on Twitter at Ben Dubose or at Locked In Rockets as the show handle. David, of course, is the voice of the Utah Jazz. He's on Twitter at Locked On Sports, and of course, you'll hear him calling all the games across the Jazz radio network. Good stuff there from David Locke. Thought it was a fairly balanced take from the Jazz side of the fence about the large mountain they have to climb in this series. Hopefully we'll be able to get him on at least a couple more times throughout this series to get some input from the Utah side of things. Anyway, I think we've talked enough basketball for one day because, well, we're less than 24 hours removed now as I'm recording this, and probably as you are listening, from Game 1 actually tipping off at 2:30 Houston time on Sunday afternoon. So for now, I'm going to enjoy the rest of my Saturday. Hopefully you guys are able to do the same, and we'll be talking again Sunday afternoon shortly after that Game 1 is officially in the books. Again, you want more content between now and then, best place to find me is always on Twitter. I'm at Ben DuBose. The show is at Locked On Rockets. Also email lockedonrockets@gmail.com. It's a good place to get questions about the team, suggestions for the show, advertising inquiries. Would absolutely love to hear from you. Also, we've got a Facebook. That's facebook.com/lockedonrockets. A website, lockedonrockets.com. All ways you can find our content throughout the series. Ask me questions. Whatever we can do to make this a better podcast for you, the diehard Rockets fan, we absolutely want to do that. And don't forget, if you listen to us, well, wherever you do, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Megaphone, you can also find other shows across the Locked On Podcast Network. That includes all the NBA teams still in the playoffs, including David Shuchat Jazz. And we've also got shows covering the NFL and even a little bit of MLB. The Texans across town, they've got their draft going on this weekend, so if you want to hear thoughts about what the Texans did or what they didn't do, then check out Locked On Texans, hosted by my buddies Robert Land and Brian Patterson. You can find them on the same platforms that you listen to me here at Locked On Rockets. Also, leave all of us 5-star reviews if you can. Subscribe, because that's how we can remain viable to advertisers and keep going as the only daily podcast covering the Rockets. So until tomorrow, I will sign off. Again, thanks as always to you guys for listening, and we'll be talking again shortly after Game 1 right here at Locked On Rockets, the only daily podcast covering the NBA's winningest team.